Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Grant at 200, Reconsidering the Life and Legacy of Ulysses S. Grant. Edited by Chris Makowski and Frank J. Scaturo. Narrated by Rick Adamson. From General Colin L. Powell, Chairman, Joint Chiefs of Staff. With respect to General Grant, I confess to being an admirer of his tremendous ability to fashion a path to success despite adversity along the way. The chief lessons I draw from Grant's generalship are the value of bold initiative and the absolute necessity for calm in the middle of danger, uncertainty, and the inevitable fog of war. In my view, his most brilliant campaign came at Vicksburg. There, after several setbacks, he maneuvered completely around the city, isolated the fortress from reinforcements, and won a decisive victory. Throughout that campaign and the Virginia campaign of 1864-65, his unflappable leadership steadied the Union Army and turned tactical setbacks into operational triumphs. From a June 28, 1991 letter to Frank Scaturo. Forward. Ulysses S. Grant at 200. By Frank J. Williams. Momentous events during a president's term and his response thereto define his legacy. Theodore Roosevelt acknowledged this fact as he said, "A man has to take advantage of his opportunities, but the opportunities have to come. If there is not the war, you don't get the great general. If there is not a great occasion, you don't get the great statesman. If Lincoln had lived in times of peace, no one would have known his name now." That the circumstances of a presidency define the president in the eyes of future generations is exemplified by our nation's collective memory of Ulysses S. Grant. Momentous events surrounded Ulysses S. Grant's life. During the Civil War, Grant earned President Abraham Lincoln's complete confidence. The general made his fair share of mistakes during the Civil War, but he was a great wartime leader. He learned from his mistakes, listening to and asking questions of his advisors. During the Civil War, he and President Lincoln directed the war effort in concert. By 1864, Grant had become a respected strategist and tactician. His efforts led to the creation of one of his most enduring legacies, the modern command system the military still uses. The modern command system, developed by Grant and Lincoln, was led by the Commander-in-Chief, President Lincoln himself, who set overall strategy for the prosecution of the war. Grant, as General-in-Chief, executed President Lincoln's overall strategy. His function was to plan and direct the movements of the entirety of the Union Army. Between them was a Chief of Staff, Major General Henry Halleck, who relayed information to both Grant and Lincoln. Grant may not have known it at the time, but this relationship with Lincoln set a precedent that the executive branch and the United States military still follow to this day. When Congress reauthorized the rank of Lieutenant General with Grant in mind, Lincoln feared that Grant might get the political bug and challenge him for the Republican Party presidential nomination in 1864. When he was assured this was not the case, Lincoln promoted Grant. Grant's leadership justified Lincoln's belief in his capacity and abilities. Grant possessed the ability to see the whole picture of the military conflict. He worked to harmonize his strategic thinking with the overall strategy Lincoln prescribed. Grant directed the Union to confront Confederate armies from all sides, attempting to punish those armies, not Confederate cities, with strong and decisive coordinated attacks. He submitted to Lincoln broad outlines of his battle plans. Lincoln trusted Grant's analysis and approved the plans without seeking details. Although Grant's achievements during the Civil War may not be considered as part of his presidential legacy, those momentous events shaped Grant and the nation as a whole. The military model he spawned is a brilliant illustration of simplicity. Military leaders to this day continue to study that system and his leadership that ended the Civil War. Little more than 3 years after the Civil War, the Republican Party nominated Grant as its candidate for president. Grant reluctantly accepted the nomination, writing to William T. Sherman on June 21, 1868, that it is a position I would not occupy for any mere personal consideration, but from the nature of the contest since the close of active hostilities, I have been forced into it in spite of myself. Grant's reluctance to become president did not render him an ineffective national leader. In fact, as recently as 2021, C-SPAN's Presidential Historians Survey rated Grant number 20 out of the 44 U.S. presidents who had served, excluding the incumbent. He ranked highest under the poll's Pursued Equal Justice for All category as the sixth highest, while his administrative skills were ranked at number 36. Yet to this day, Grant's presidency seems to be overshadowed by the surrounding events of his life. With the rise of the media relations profession and the 24-hour news cycle in the late 20th and early 21st centuries, not to mention the omnipresence of the internet, public figures, from politicians to athletes, CEOs to celebrities, are shaped and preened by professionals in the hopes of capturing the nation's attention in a positive manner. For celebrities, the electorate appears to tolerate misrepresentations by the press for the sake of human interest. However, coverage of the government demands rigorous honesty, sometimes lost amid the turmoil in current political news coverage. This news is consumed by a ravenous public, always hoping for more information, from newspaper articles to social media. 19th-century Americans were as hungry for information about prominent individuals as we are today. However, sources of that information were less widely or quickly available. Grant was one of those prominent individuals. By the end of the Civil War, Americans knew him and most considered him a hero who helped to save the Union. His luster may even have surpassed that of Lincoln, as shown by the throngs of Americans who paid their respects during Grant's funeral, the many photographs taken of Grant as compared with Lincoln, and various other metrics. After being elected president, Grant planned his time in office with self-confidence and independence. He believed that he understood the American people and their wants. Republican members of Congress, having been victorious over Grant's predecessor, President Andrew Johnson, had no intention of yielding to President Grant their legislative agenda, prerogatives, and supplies of patronage opportunities. However, when Grant took office, he was determined to enforce civil rights legislation, reform Indian policy, and maintain a transparent government. He was met with obstacles and criticism for this agenda, not only from Democrats, but also from members of his own party. President Grant maintained a stoic silence when criticized. He thought that answering these criticisms would simply lead to more. He opted to leave approval of his performance to the people. But even before Grant's second term, scandals from his administration began to unfold in the press. None involved Grant directly, nor his honesty or integrity. Yet each scandal diminished Grant's administration in the American people's eyes. However, individual Americans continued to embrace Grant and his leadership. He was also challenged, as any president would have been, by the Panic of 1873, which forced Grant to confront an economic crisis for which he had little experience and fewer solutions. Many have written about General Grant, ending their narratives at Appomattox, seemingly wishing he had accepted President Lincoln's invitation to the theater. In fact, since it was taken over by the National Park Service in 1959, Grant's resting place has been officially named the General Grant National Memorial. But biographies such as Ronald C. White's American Ulysses, Ron Chernow's Grant, Charles W. Calhoun's The Presidency of Ulysses S. Grant, and Joan Waugh's U.S. Grant, American Hero, American Myth, have done much to reconcile the disparate opinions regarding Grant's generalship and presidency. Until recently, colleges and universities with American History Survey courses seemed almost uniformly to end the first semester with the close of the Civil War. This meant that college students learned of Grant's skill and success as a general in the fall semester and returned after winter break to study Grant's supposedly inept presidency. But as American history has itself continued to grow, more American history courses are divided at 1877 or later. Nevertheless, American college students are introduced to two different and at odds Grants. These differing portraits of General Grant and President Grant may lead to an inability to understand Ulysses S. Grant as a complex but consequential president. These misunderstandings show a broader misunderstanding of the crucial period of American history that many have to this day. Yet today we must strive to understand him as one individual who helped shape the nation we live in today, just as the essays in this book accomplish. Frank J. Williams, President, Ulysses S. Grant Presidential Library and Association. Presidential Messages. In honor of Ulysses S. Grant's 200th birthday, all six living U.S. presidents issued commemorative messages, shared here courtesy of the Grant Monument Association. The original documents are at Grant's tomb in New York City. The president's messages, in the order in which each chief executive served, Jimmy Carter, William Jefferson Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, Donald J. Trump, Joseph Biden. In 1866, after receiving a promotion to full general and a fourth star, Ulysses S. Grant became the highest-ranking soldier in American history up to that point, surpassing even George Washington. The highest-ranking soldier of our own time, General Mark A. Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has also shared a message with us in honor of Grant's bicentennial. Introduction. The Myth of Grant's Silence by Chris Mikowski. On May 4, 1864, Ulysses S. Grant led federal forces across the Rapidan River in central Virginia in an attempt to bring Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia to heel once and for all. He vowed there would be no turning back, and he stayed true to his word. On May 5, the two armies clashed in the Wilderness, but rather than withdraw when a decisive tactical victory seemed unlikely, Grant maneuvered around Lee's position. Fighting resumed immediately outside Spotsylvania Courthouse. After 2 weeks there, Grant maneuvered around Lee again, shifting the fight to the banks of the North Anna River, and from there on to Totopotomy Creek and Bethesda Church and Cold Harbor. Lee's failure to strike a blow at North Anna, coupled with a series of successes through June 1st, led Grant to believe he needed just one more strong assault to break his foe. "Lee's army is really whipped," he wrote to Washington following the fight at North Anna. "The prisoners we now take show it, and the action of his army shows it unmistakably." And so it was, on the morning of June 3, 1864, Grant launched a series of attacks against heavily fortified Confederate positions at Cold Harbor. As the story goes, he lost as many as 6,000 men in half an hour as the result of a single fruitless charge. In reality, he lost closer to 3,500 men over the course of the entire day, all along the line, not just during the morning's charge, but the inflated casualty figure remains a central linchpin in anti-Grant mythology. I have always regretted that the last assault at Cold Harbor was ever made, Grant famously wrote in his personal memoirs. No advantage whatever was gained to compensate for the heavy loss we sustained. It's an oft-quoted line, in part because Grant did not write much about Cold Harbor, despite the staggering losses. Historians have tended to accept his relative silence about the incident as tacit acknowledgement that he made a mistake, and lost cause mythologizers have exploited such silences to vilify him as Grant the Butcher. It's worth noting, however, that Robert E. Lee lost a similar number of men during Pickett's charge at Gettysburg, some 6,555 men, as Grant did in total at Cold Harbor. In Lee's case, that amounted to a decisive defeat, while Grant was able to maintain his strategic momentum by changing tactics after the battle. But rather than condemn Lee the Butcher, the same Southern partisans who butchered Grant's reputation romanticized Lee's, holding up his casualties as examples of Southern manly virtue. Writing more about Cold Harbor certainly would not have spared Grant from his lost cause critics, who had a vested interest in besmirching him no matter what. But Grant's omissions have at times been devastating to his historical reputation because they have given his detractors further space to control the narrative right up through the 20th century. It's easy to make assumptions about Grant's relative silence on Cold Harbor because it fits neatly in line with widely known stories of his stoicism in times of calamity. Think of Grant in the rain after the first disastrous day at Shiloh, ready to lick 'em tomorrow. Or his quiet whittling under a tree on that awful first day in the wilderness. Or the quiet attentiveness he gave Ferdinand Ward when his business partner first hinted at the financial trouble their investment firm was facing. "The general was always silent, Mrs. Grant," William T. Sherman once reminded Grant's wife Julia during the winter of Grant's final illness. "Even at the worst times of strain during the war, I used to go to see him at his headquarters, and he would sit perfectly still." Furthermore, there is Grant's well-documented reticence for public speaking. Ronald C. White's essay in this volume, for example, offers several accounts where Grant makes a quick greeting, but then turns the spotlight over to a friend or colleague to tell you how happy I am to be with you. Robert Underwood Johnson, an editor with Century Magazine tasked with convincing Grant to write about his wartime experiences, referred to the myth of his, Grant's, silence. Grant's silence was very much a part of the great man's public persona. But as Johnson found out when he met Grant for the first time in June 1884, the impressions I had of his personality and character had been at second hand, and were, as it proved, for the most part, erroneous. Johnson admitted Grant was a much misrepresented man. What was to Johnson a discovery was something well known to Grant's intimates. "We considered him more than commonly talkative," said Brigadier General William Hillier, once a member of Grant's wartime staff, speaking to a newspaper reporter around the time of Grant's inauguration as president. "So he is now. He won't talk for effect, nor before strangers freely. This reticence of Grant, so much talked of, is partly discrimination and partly the form of an old bashfulness he had when a boy. Anybody whom he knows can hear him speak at any time." Johnson's diligent work with Grant would earn him this privilege. It fell to Johnson to mentor Grant in what the editor described as the untried field of authorship, a series of battle articles for Century that would eventually lead to the memoirs. Grant first tried and struggled with an account of the Battle of Shiloh. It was dry, Johnson privately noted, and suffered from the blight of the deadly official report. As Johnson later explained, the general, of course, did not realize the requirements of a popular publication on the war, and it was for me to help him turn this new disaster of Shiloh into a signal success. His follow-up discussion with Grant proved especially illuminating. General Grant, instead of being a silent man, was positively loquacious. Johnson marveled, he spoke rapidly and long, and in the frankest manner. And, Johnson importantly added, Grant exhibited no cocksureness, no desire to make a perfect record or to live up to a later reputation. In conversation, Grant revealed the human side of his experience, and it was this approach Johnson urged him to take with his writing, such a talk as he would make to friends after dinner. Grant grasped the idea at once and set to work on a revision that worked admirably. "I am positively enjoying the work," Grant admitted, a bit surprised. If we can eavesdrop on the outskirts of these interactions for a moment, we gain important clues into Grant's silences and the limits of our ability to assume anything from them. As Johnson discovered, Grant had plenty to say, but just needed to figure out the best way to say it for his audience. Grant had never thought of himself as a writer before and so felt intimidated by the very idea. Once he got past that mystification, though, he discovered he wasn't nearly the stranger to the pen he initially thought he was. "I have been very much employed in writing," he one day wrote to former staff officer Adam Badeau. "As a soldier, I wrote my own orders, directions, and reports. They were not edited nor assistance rendered. As president, I wrote every official document, I believe, bearing my name. All these have been published and widely circulated. The public has become accustomed to them and know my style of writing. They know that it is not even an attempt to imitate either a literary or classical style, and that it is just what it is, pure and simple and nothing else. If I succeed in telling my story so that others can see as I do what I attempt to show, I will be satisfied. The reader must also be satisfied, for he knew from the beginning just what to expect." By the time Grant got around to writing about the Overland campaign in his memoirs, he was in his last weeks of life, fighting excruciating pain from throat cancer, not to mention the mind-addling effects of painkillers and exhaustion. His attempt to finish the second volume of his memoirs represents a Herculean effort. All three of his sons were aiding him by that point, as well as stenographer Noble Dawson. "If I could have 2 weeks of strength, I could improve it very much," he wrote to his publisher, Mark Twain, around June 30, 1885. "As I am, however, it will have to go about as it is, with verifications and corrections by the boys, and by suggestions which will enable me to make a point clear here and there." As it would happen, Grant would get 3 weeks, not two. He would die on July 23, 1885. The clock was ticking. Grant was satisfied with most of what he had written concerning the last year of the war. "It seemed to me that I got the campaign about Petersburg and the move to Appomattox pretty good on the last attempt," he told his son Fred, who worked as his primary editorial assistant. Grant was also pleased with the Wilderness. He was less pleased, though, with the rest of the Overland campaign. "I should change spots if I was able," he told Fred in early July, "and could improve North Anna and Cold Harbor." But he was not able, of course. The clock was ticking loudly by that point. If I could read it, the manuscript, over myself, many little matters of anecdote and incident would suggest themselves to me, he had told Twain. And indeed, his daughters-in-law read the manuscript back to him in the afternoons and evenings, even as his sons and Dawson continued with their editing and fact-checking. Tell Mr. Dawson to punctuate, he added. Grant was generally unable to speak by this point because his throat cancer had ravaged his voice and sapped his strength so badly. He held conversations and passed out instructions by writing on slips of paper. His scrawlings show a dozen aspects of the book, all competing for his attention. We will consider whether or not to leave out the appendix. Is that entitled Preface or Introduction? What are you engaged at now? Does what I have written fit the case? Are you reviewing or copying? I think I am a little mixed in my statement. Mentions of Chattanooga, Knoxville, and Generals Sherman, Burnside, Longstreet. Have I left out many points? A question without a question mark. No wonder he needed Dawson to punctuate. I begin to feel anxious about the review of the second volume, he admitted around July 10th. There may be more difficulty in placing all the parts than we think. It has been written in a very detached way. It is no wonder, in this maelstrom of edits, that Grant did not have time to do all he wished, although he tried mightily. Even as Twain sent him printed galley proofs of Volume 1, Grant kept making handwritten corrections on the sheets. Twain fretted that the editing on the first volume would prohibit Grant from finishing the second. I would have more hope of satisfying the expectation of the public if I could have allowed myself more time, Grant admitted in his introduction to the memoirs. Imagine, if he'd had more time, what more might he have said? As someone who has been telling the story of the Overland campaign for nearly two decades, on the battlefield and in writing, this notion tantalizes me. I should change spots if I was able and could improve North Anna and Cold Harbor. How would Grant have retold those stories? What changes would he have made? What was he feeling at the time? What did he really think about that last charge at Cold Harbor? He always regretted it, he said, but we students of the Civil War have always regretted he didn't say more. Had he the time, what else did Grant wish he could improve, change, expand upon, or illuminate? What other anecdotes and incidents would have suggested themselves to him? What else might he have told us? Consider how such first-person revelations might have altered our understanding of Grant or changed the way history has remembered him. Remember, Johnson's second-hand impressions of Grant had proven erroneous. How erroneous are our own impressions of Grant in the absence of his own testimony and in the face of hostile Lost Cause critics? For three-quarters of a century after Grant's death, historians complained about an almost complete lack of Grant resources to look at. No compiled letters, no journals, no collected works, just the memoir. Grant wrote as little as possible, one of them groused. There was, in a sense, a documentary silence from Grant, keeping in line with the in-person myth of his silence, as Johnson called it. This speaks to one of the great paradoxes of Grant's legacy. His memoirs, which have never gone out of print, consisted of 291,000 words over 1,231 pages in two volumes. Recent annotated editions have shed additional light on the text. Beyond Grant's masterwork, The Papers of Ulysses S. Grant, edited under the auspices of the Ulysses S. Grant Association and published by Southern Illinois University Press, fill 32 volumes, and his written orders from the war are sprinkled throughout the official records of the War of the Rebellion. Grant really wasn't all that silent after all, even if he didn't get the chance to say quite everything he wanted to. Grant's silences, then, were both real and imagined. This is the true myth of his silence. Lost causers have exploited those silences, and historians have often made wholly inadequate assumptions.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?